Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
This is the Happy Station Show, Tribute to Radio.
Well, hello everyone, hello everywhere. Welcome again to another edition of the International Happy Station Show. Keith Parent here with you for the next 55 minutes. Our website for this show, as well as the other programs from PCJ, is www.pcjmedia.com. As you can tell from our opening, we're doing another one of our Tribute to Radio specials. And today is a very, very, very interesting show, and definitely informative and a lot of fun. But I thought, let's begin with a song about radio. It's called Jukebox Radio and TV. Here's Jimmy Donnelly on the International Happy Station. Jimmy Donnelly, Jukebox Radio and TV, beginning today's International Happy Station Show, Tribute to Radio. Now we're going to begin with a song that all of you know, but except there's one thing, and that is the lyrics were changed. Listen carefully, and I should mention that I don't support any of the ideas that are in these lyrics. I just wanted to make that clear.
Listen to the BBC, BBC, BBC. Listen to the BBC, tra-la-la-la-la. Who's preaching world democracy, democracy, democracy. Who wants to make free people free? Tra-la-la-la-la. First they won the war in France, then they said they had no chance. Each time the Germans did advance, how could they have a chance? They told stories so divine, often marched across the Rhine. Germans eat only rats and mice, but in England all was fine. Bye-bye Churchill, BBC, BBC, BBC. Your tricks won't work with Italy, tra-la-la-la-la. Why not give us different news, different news, different news? Skip those Soviets, skip those Jews, tra-la-la-la-la.
The song, of course, is Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf. It was renamed Listen to the BBC, and it was performed by Charlie and his orchestra. They were recorded at the Rundhaus Funk in Germany. During the Second World War, Charlie and his orchestra recorded a number of songs that were relayed on the Rundhaus Funk towards the British troops and the Allies, where they would take popular songs of the day and, like we heard, just change the lyrics. Most of these recordings were played on a show called Jerry's Front that was hosted by Mildred Gillers. She was nicknamed Axis Sally.
This is Jerry's Front calling. This program, especially dedicated to you men of the British Fighting Forces, goes on the air every night from 10:15 p.m. to 11 p.m. on the medium wave 391 and 449.1 meters and short wave 28, 31 and 39.6 meters.
And that was Mildred Gillers, a.k.a. Axis Sally, opening up an edition of Jerry's Front. There is a new book, which is to be out very soon, called Axis Sally, The American Voice of Nazi Germany, by Richard Lucas. It is the first fully documented biography of the notorious World War II broadcaster. It is coming out October 19th. I had a chance to speak to Richard recently to find out more about the book. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today. Now, many people know the history of some well-known propaganda broadcasters. Probably the most famous of them all is a guy by the name of William Joyce. He was nicknamed by the British as Lord Haw Haw. And then, of course, there was Tokyo Rose out of Japan, which actually wasn't just one woman. It actually was a number of different women. But there's also a woman that got the nickname Axis Sally. Now, you've just written a biography about her. Her name is Mildred Gillers. And I'm just curious, why did you decide to write a biography about her?
Well, I had heard several of her broadcasts over the internet, and I started to do more and more research on her, and I realized that there had been no nonfiction biography of her. It was very, very difficult to get any sort of accurate information about her. There had been a lot of myths about how she got to Germany, how she ended up in this position, and I became more fascinated with the story and exactly how this woman got into this position, and it quite simply took her life in a completely different direction. And it's not only an interesting story; it's a tragic one.
The question, though, is how do you research such a thing? I mean, if you talk about, let's say, you know, her life before she went to Germany, that must have been quite difficult, or was the documentation all around?
there were several places to look, including her college archives at Ohio Wesleyan. She had long interviews with the Counterintelligence Corps after the war. And in addition to that, I was able to locate at the Library of Congress papers by a former ambassador who worked for a magazine during her trial. And he had interviewed her sister, her half-sister. And not only in his papers did I find information and notes on her past as a child, but also a trial transcript of the trial itself, which the National Archives in Maryland had lost. So it was difficult. That was probably the most difficult part of writing this book, was what about her time before Germany? What about where was she, tracking her down? Because she was an actress in New York and in Cleveland. And basically you had to track where she was on the road and the things she had become involved with along that time. She had left Ohio with basically $20 in her pocket and without her parents' blessing, and had to make her life as an actress. And in a lot of ways, she failed. So it was a difficult slog for her. And she finally, at the time of the Depression, decided that she would look for greener pastures in Europe.
You know, when we hear the stories of William Joyce, everybody knew that, you know, the story, of course, is that, you know, before he went to Germany, he was involved in the British nationalist movement. Broadcasters, one of the most famous females that was nicknamed Tokyo Rose, she was just an American Japanese who just happened to be in Tokyo at the time and just was sort of, you know, forced into doing it. But what about with Mildred Joers? I mean, what was her political background before she went to Germany? And did she just get caught up in the whole movement that was going on in Germany at that time?
She was almost entirely apolitical. I mean, one thing that comes throughout the entire research is that up until that point, she was basically apolitical. But she did fall under the influence of the men in her life. And she also is very susceptible to German propaganda. She lived in Germany from 1934 on, became quite enthralled with the pomp of it all. And she started to actually, she was able to keep jobs. She worked as a film critic. She did dubbing for UFA. She did several different jobs. She wrote for Variety on a per-job basis. So she was more successful in Germany as an American expatriate than she ever was in the United States. And then what happened was she became involved with a German citizen, a man named Paul, and he told her when war broke out that he would not marry her unless she stayed in Germany, that if she went home at the behest of the U.S. Embassy, he would not marry her. And then what ended up happening was, at the end of the day, he was sent to the Eastern Front and was reportedly killed. And she, once again, was alone. Mm-hmm. And by that time, Pearl Harbor had occurred. The United States was in the war, and she had no way out.
You know, it's interesting. When I've listened to some of those broadcasts that she did,
yes.
Despite, you know, the political slant, and when you listen to them today, they are, the message that comes across is rather disgusting. But from a professional point of view, she was extremely professional in her presentation and even her style. I mean, despite the message, the evil message that she was trying to get across.
Yes, she was good on her feet. As a matter of fact, she bragged to the bragged to her captors when she was brought over in 1948 to the United States. She was bragging that she had almost done a lot of that stuff. A lot of the words that she spoke were off the cuff. Some of it was written, some of it was written by her manager and lover, Max Adequishwitz. But she was also very adept at being able to work extemporaneously, and was in fact very good at it and very professional.
Mm-hmm. After she was...
But part of that comes from her acting. You know, she was an actress at heart.
Well, after the war and after she was sent back to the United States, what was life like for her?
She went through a period of the trial where she was completely reviled. And then she served 12 years in a West Virginia prison in Alderson. And some of the listeners might recall that name because Martha Stewart served time there recently.
Mm-hmm.
It was a women's prison. Basically, they would call them cottages. They would use the photo studio and the sewing room and like that. But it was a difficult place because actually one of the best accounts of life in Alderson Prison in the 1950s was from a convicted communist who served time at the same time as Mildred.
Mm-hmm.
And she discusses her in some length in her book. But it's very, it was not easy for her as she was very reviled, very, she kept to herself, and whereas she always sought fame in the early stages of her life, and that brought her to Germany and brought her to the radio. Later in life, she was intensely, intensely private. And when she was released on parole in 1961, she was given a job at a convent in Columbus, Ohio, where she jealously guarded her privacy largely up until her death in 1988.
So when she was released on parole until her death in 1998, she didn't grant any interviews with anybody about what she had done in Germany during the Second World War.
Well, when she was released and she was walking out of Alderson, they followed her. The press followed her along the route from West Virginia to Ohio. And she granted some interviews the day after. But only occasionally would she speak to the press. And in one case, the only reason, and I spoke to the woman who actually took this interview in 1967. She was a young girl. Her father's brother or uncle was a Monsignor in the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
and Mildred had converted to Catholicism in prison. And she granted an interview with this young girl. As a matter of fact, the reporter told me that when she was a young reporter, it was kind of a joke among the people at United Press, try to go get an interview with her, that's your first job. and they would laugh. You know, it was like a joke. But she nailed this interview with her in 1967. And, of course, she asked her about the Vietnam War. What do you think of the Vietnam War? And she said, who am I to talk about wars? I don't want any sort of, comment about any wars that have ever gone on. Because she was done with politics, done with any sort of political involvement at all. She was jealously private. She would only speak about the church, about prison life, and she changed her life quite a bit in that time.
Do you think, from the research that you were doing and also writing the book, do you think that, you know, she became private because she looked at what she had done, the messages that she was broadcasting, and felt very kind of wished that she hadn't done that.
I think she was a very proud woman, and I think she was very reticent about being able to say I was wrong. They would ask her, these interviews in 1961, would you have done it differently? She said, of course I would have done it differently had I known what I know now. And she doesn't really get to the answer of, she always maintained that she did not know what was happening to the Jews in Berlin, even though she was there in Berlin at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But she was very, very adamant about how could I have made any other choice. I think at the end of the day, she had regrets. I'm sure she did. But publicly, she still maintained to stuck to the explanations that you see many people have. Who have been in Vichy or have been involved in the war, that she was either not aware or she was or couldn't have had any other choice.
Mm-hmm. Was there any information when you were writing this that looked into what her life was like at the German radio at that time, and relationships that, let's say, she had with William Joyce and other Brits and Americans that were broadcasting propaganda?
Well, she was quite, she had been on the radio with Margaret Joyce.
Oh, okay.
Several times. Now, she, and Margaret Joyce was known as Lady Haha. They had largely done programs for women. They would have panels where Mrs. Joyce and Max Otto Koschwitz's daughters would sing, and they would have Constance Drexel and some of the other American radio hosts would be on a panel. As far as Joyce, after some point in the war, he started to broadcast farther and farther away from, they started to disperse somewhere around 1943 when the bombing in Berlin became very, very bad. And the broadcasting house in the center of Berlin, they started to evacuate. They would move to a suburban studio out in out by the transmitters in the suburbs of Berlin. And more and more they would broadcast from Hilversum or from other locations throughout the occupied territories.
So you mean some of the broadcasts also didn't stem from Germany, they would stem from the Netherlands or Belgium or from even France?
Yeah, that's correct. They did some of the broadcasting, for example, Koschwitz and Mildred went out in 1943, 1944 to prisoner of war camps to do interviews with American and Canadian prisoners of war. And she put a program on called Survivors of the Invasion Front, Christmas Bells of 1943, and Easter Bells of 1944. And what they would do is do interviews in the camps, the POW camps, with these prisoners, the flyers who had been shot down over Germany. And, of course, you would ask them leading questions like, are you glad you're out of the war? Are you glad that it's over for you? You know, in an attempt to make the listener feel like, well, if I get captured, I'm out of the thick of it. And now she would go back, and they would do the editing in Hilversum.
In the Netherlands.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, she was in Hilversum in 1944, late August 1944, when her manager and her lover, Koischwitz, was called back to Berlin, and where he died in September of tuberculosis in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And she rushed back from Hoversum to Berlin. She bribed her way on the train to Berlin so that she could go to the funeral. So she had been throughout France. She had been as far as France and Hoversum doing editing of the radio programs, and they had assembled a large amount of programs of interviews with POWs and had done it outside of Germany itself.
When I was listening to some of the recordings of those programs, if nobody's ever heard it, usually they had a swing band on the show.
Yes.
Which was quite unique because it sounded like, I mean, it was music that was banned in Germany at the time, and they would sing songs. They'd sing maybe part of the chorus that was the original lyric, and then, of course, they would change the lyric, usually in the second verse, and then they would end the song with the original verse. You know, you kind of wonder, when she was, let's say, reading scripts, because the Nazi propaganda at the time, if you look at, say, propaganda from, say, the past 100 years, they, okay, despite the message, and I want to make that clear, the evil message that they were putting across, they were, in many ways, brilliant at using media as a medium.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they were. And they, besides the message that they were trying to convey, they would parody songs that were popular of the day against Churchill, against Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to some of those recordings, there was one program called Invasion Calling that was almost completely consisting of parodies and that the band would play live. Mildred Gillis was a driving force behind getting the Germans to use, the way she phrased it, live bands instead of dead records.
Mm-hmm.
She was just spinning records at one point. She actually complained and said, you know, we need a band in here. So she got a band in her show. And she would, you know, they would call them different things, Charlie and his orchestra or Dick and his foot warmers. But they made it listenable
mm-hmm.
to large amounts of listeners and GIs.
Those broadcasts that were done at the time, is there any estimate around maybe perhaps how many people did actually tune in, or how many people actually heard these broadcasts, or were they targeted mainly towards the military forces in Europe?
Well, early in the war, there were estimates. I know BBC Monitoring did estimates of how many people were listening to Haw Haw after the 9 p.m. news, and it was probably 1 to 3. And I go over in the book about why in Britain there was so little news about what was going on at the time that they would immediately turn to see what Lord Haw Haw was saying to find out what the government was holding back. But as the war went on, it became more targeted towards the U.S. staying out of the war.
Mm-hmm.
That was the propaganda line. And then in 1942, 1943, North Africa and the Italian fronts, so much so that the other Axis ally, and there was another Axis ally who broadcast out of Rome after Mildred experienced some success, she was attached to a military unit in Italy as the Germans retreated. So it became more targeted towards the forces of the British and the United States forces in Africa, North Africa. And some of those broadcasts that Mildred had done, you can actually hear she's targeting the boys in French North Africa, and she will refer to them over and over. As they got closer to the German to the German homeland, they became even more targeted, and you hear accounts from soldiers at that time, or GIs, who say, she knew where I was, she knew where our platoon was, she knew where our company was headed, and that's where you start to realize that she was actually receiving some military intelligence from the Germans to be able to identify where they were. So it became more and more targeted towards the invasion forces in 1944, and as the war went on, it became more specific and more targeted to individual groups.
Richard, one final question. Why did you decide to write this book, and why now?
Well, for one thing, there had been no book on Axis Sally. And secondly, in the United States, we have had the first treason indictment since the 1950s with the indictment of Adnan Gaddan for his propaganda work with Al-Qaeda. And I thought it would be timely and interesting and something that no one had ever done before. There have been several books on Tokyo Rose, on how she was located and arrested, but none on Miss Gillers that was nonfiction. So I think it's a good time to start to discuss the meaning of propaganda, the meaning of her actions, and look at it with a view towards what's happening today.
Richard, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much, Keith.
And I was speaking there with Richard Lewis, the author of Axis Sally, The American Voice of Nazi Germany. It's being published in October by Casemate Publishing. You can check them out online at www.casematepublishing.com. That's www.casematepublishing.com. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the International Happy Station. This is another one of our programs in the series, A Tribute to Radio. Check us out online, www.pcjmedia.com, and do take part in the poll, the new poll, that is, that we have running, which is, do you think DRM, that's Digital Radio Mondial, will survive? Just go to our website and take part in the poll. Well, a little bit of Russian music for our next story. Now, quite recently, there's been a lot of buzz. Oh, I shouldn't have used that word. It's not really appropriate. Oh, well, but doesn't matter. But anyway, it's about the Russian buzzer station. Yes, a cold joke, isn't it? The station is known as UVB 76. Recently, there's been a lot of stuff on the internet about the station because there's been some very odd goings-on. So I decided to contact a guy that has set up a website where he's streaming this stuff from this radio station that not too many people know anything about. It's one of those unofficial official stations, or official unofficial station, or official secret act station. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So I contacted Andres Aslade in Estonia to talk about UVB 76. It's quite fascinating. Let me ask you, the radio station UVB 76, what is it exactly? Because people have nicknamed the station the Russian buzzer station.
The truth is, if you ask about what the station is, then this is pretty clear. It's a shortwave radio transmitter somewhere it seems, somewhere near Moscow, somewhere about 50 kilometers from Moscow. And it seems to be pretty ordinary shortwave station, in a sense that it doesn't transmit too loud, it doesn't transmit too strange, it is just a supposedly a 10 kilowatt shortwave transmitter transmitting on 4.625 megahertz. Now that's where the ordinarities end, because it has two characters why people have sort of become fond of it, and then why it's growing more and more popular. The first is that the content it's transmitting is weird is not the right word, but it transmits a constant buzzing sound, which is repeated about, I can't exactly say, but maybe 20 times a minute or something mm-hmm. like that. And it's just a buzzing, and it has been a buzzing for year or even more, when all of a sudden there will be a short voice messages which are written in Russian and quite cryptic. So the content itself is one thing. The other thing is that it has been transmitting nearly 30 years non-stop. And that's making it a little bit special, because for something which is, in a first glance, not so meaningful signal, to keep it on the air throughout all the power shifts in Russia, throughout all the political changes and everything, just continuously for 30 years, means that it has some sense for the guys running it.
So then even in the days like before the collapse of the Berlin Wall, before the changes in the Soviet Union to now what it is, Russia, the station has continuously nonstop been there.
Well, at least this is what everybody is reporting. There are different sources. One say that it is transmitting as long as since 78. There are some sources that say 82, some say 80, but it seems that it's certainly somewhere around the 80s when it started. And there have been a group of people who have been monitoring it for several years, and they've been catching it pretty quickly if something strange is going on. So they have reported only like one or two occasions when it has stopped. Mm-hmm. So it is a little bit too well maintained to be just a scientific project, but to be just somebody's hobby somewhere.
Right. Do people put this station in the same category as the spy number stations? Does it fit into that category?
People tend to categorize it like that, but the question is that it's not actually a classic spy station or number station, like it's called, which is then used for communicating with agents on the field. It is not a classic one in a sense that it is actually a little weak for doing it, because it is transmitting with the 10 kilowatt power, what makes it, well, pretty, by shortwave standards, it makes it about 500 kilometer range. Mm-hmm. What means that it is, if it's for the intelligence work, then it's made for intelligence work inside Russia, which is pretty senseless. So in other words,
it's for intelligence agents that never leave home.
Well, yes, exactly. So although it is categorized like that, it puts it clearly out of the normal number stations list. However, it transmits cryptic voice messages, what mm-hmm. means that it is certainly also meant for delivering some data to somebody at some point. But it's likely for the guys inland,
right,
rather than abroad.
You know, I quite recently I was reading some interesting stories that during their broadcast, it sounded as if they had a microphone in wherever they are that was open, because they said they can hear technicians talking, they can hear telephones ringing.
Well, it is much better than that, actually, because your interview comes at a very, very, very right moment about the station, because there's been a lot going on in a couple of past days. We all of a sudden discovered the last afternoon that the transmission has been stopped and the station is totally silent, nothing, no carrier, no buzzing, anything. So what happened was that we were waiting for the signal, just chatting randomly with different guys, wondering about what could go on. And all of a sudden at 1:20 at the night, local time, all of a sudden it started to play a little swan's dance from the Swan Lake.
After 1 o'clock in the morning, they started to play Swan Lake.
Yes, it actually seems that there is some serious maintenance going on at the station because there are some random carrier bits happening and disappearing. But yesterday night, the guys were playing a test sequence that consisted of a little piece of Swan Lake and then about 5, 6, 7 buzzes, and then a little bit silence, and then Swan Lake.
That's so funny. I could just imagine it. Like, one of the technicians is sitting there saying, "Oh, I have my iPod. I wonder what happens if would this go on the air."
Well, we were seriously wondering that if they've actually come to knowing that it's listened on the internet and it was dedicated to the listeners.
Now,
You guys have a sense of humor.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, you have a website which is www.uvb-76.net. Just out of curiosity, I mean, because this station itself, has anybody ever asked Russian authorities what the position, do they know about this station, first of all, and do they have a position, or have they asked and they went, "No, we have no such station in Russia"?
Well, it's pretty hard to deny if to transmit at 10 kilowatts. So, actually, it was the project that started when they first got off air at the beginning of June this year. And it was first just a funny thing to do, to put it on the internet and hooking it all up. And then it sort of started to grow, and at some point I put a disclaimer on the website that if somebody feels that their rights have been violated, please contact me, because it's obviously somebody's broadcast I'm relaying. At the same time, the nature of these shortwave stations are that they are open air, in a sense that if I'm transmitting something on a shortwave, it can be heard with good conditions at that half of the world or even further away. So whoever is transmitting it has clearly, since the first day of the transmissions, relying on the fact that it can be heard by whoever, whenever. So I don't think that station owners actually feel the slightest bit of worry that they have a fan club now on the internet that follows them. And I don't know, I think it has been a quite nice PR campaign for the station. So.
You know, it's rather funny because about a year ago, I interviewed a guy in Australia. He monitors a lot of satellite transmissions. And he picked up in Australia and he discovered what channel the Chinese use to send their jamming signal to the various transmitter sites around China. It was in one of the audio subcarriers for one of the domestic channels, and he recorded it and he released it on CD, and he wrote a letter, an official letter, to the Chinese government saying, "I apologize, I hope this is not a infringe on any copyright or anything," hoping to hear back from them in some way, but he's never heard anything.
Well, under the circumstances, it's probably a good thing that he didn't hear back from them.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And just once again, the website is www.uvb-76.net. And for those that actually may want to try the frequency, it's 4.625 megahertz. But in case, you know, you're nowhere near a 10 kilowatt shortwave frequency, if you're listening right now to this show in Australia or North America, you can also check out their website because they have the Russian buzzer stream. Now, that is unusual, I have to say. It'll be like a spy number station saying, "Oh, yes, we're now on iTunes."
At some point, I will probably receive a request that maintaining the 10 kilowatt will lose a lot of electricity just for nothing. That could I perhaps relay the stream straight on and they will transmit it to me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun, and I'm sure that the mystery will continue.
Yes, and the other thing, what I sort of discovered during this project is that there are a lot of people who are actually interested about the shortwave listening, and it seems like a hobby which has been somewhere disappeared for a while, and now all of a sudden, because of the UVB 76, everybody have discovered that, wow, there's a shortwave and there's all strange, strange signals going on. So I think it's a good thing and good hobby for the people. And I've been meeting a lot of very, very nice people throughout this project. So I want to thank them, everybody, and then let's hope it comes back tonight and stays on for another 30 years like that.
Now that's what I call fascinating, streaming a spy number station over the internet. You can check it out yourself. The website is www.uvb-76.net. Once again, www.uvb-76.net. And on the website, by the way, there is a link so you can have it streamed to you. Now, if for whatever reason you want to try picking them up on a shortwave radio, it's actually quite easy to do, but it depends where you are, because the station is apparently running less than like 20 watts of power. So it depends where you are. It has like a reach of around maybe up to like 1,000 kilometers. But you may try 4625 kilohertz, 4625 kilohertz in the upper sideband. And if you go to the website, you'll find some unusual clips of things that have been happening from like September the 12th, 13th, and 14th. Music things and all, it's very weird. It's just very, very odd. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. Before we go, I want to remind you of a couple of things. First, that is PCJ Radio. Now, this weekend on PCJ Radio, that's the 18th and 19th of September, we're running a Happy Station Show marathon, as suggested by a few of our listeners. So during a 48-hour period, we're going to be bringing you some of the best shows going back to March 2009. You can find out all the details at our website, www.pcjmedia.com. So if you're listening to this show right now and you want to hear what's running on our stream, just go and check us out. Which leads to the question that somebody asked. They said, well, if you're doing that, does that mean you're preempting all the other shows? No, all the other shows from PCJ will be on the website, and they'll be streaming at Live 365, but you can download all the shows anytime you want. The shows are, of course, this one, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, Network Europe Week from Radio Netherlands, Arts on the Air, Switzerland in Sound with Bob Zanotti, Finally Friday with Neil Hendrickse from South Africa, Nash Holos with the wonderfully wacky Paulette Macquarie, and Vintage Media Network with Jonathan Marks. And the show with Jonathan this week is a fascinating one because it was a guest that we had on this show a couple of months ago by the name of Vasily Strelnikov, who hosted Vasily's Weekend on the World Service of Radio Moscow. And if you listen to this edition of Media Network from 20 years ago, you can hear Vasily again talking 20 years ago about some rather fascinating inside scoop about what was going on really at Radio Moscow at the time. So do check that out. And by the way, in case you didn't know, you can subscribe to all the programs from PCJ using iTunes. It's very easy. Now, for example, I'm looking at the internet right now. If, let's say, I click on Switzerland in Sound or Classic Media Network, you have at the bottom of the page all the shows listed in chronological order from the most recent. And then you'll see a link that says, if you wish to subscribe to either Switzerland in Sound or Vintage Media Network using iTunes, click here. You click on that, it will bring you to another page. And then when you're at that page, all you have to do is click on subscribe in iTunes, which you'll find at the right of that menu. And that's all you need to do. And you can even download them from that page or our page itself. So just go to www.pcjmedia.com. And while you're there, do take part in the Happy Station Show Friendship Sponsorship Program. You can become a silver member for $1, gold member for $5, or a platinum member for $10. And if you become a platinum member for $10, that means you can take part in some of the special offers that we will have in the PCJ shop very soon. And because we'll get your address, we will send you a little thank you note. The first batch, by the way, have just been sent out, Johan assures me. Yes, they have been sent out. And we have another batch that will be leaving the post next Tuesday. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. So a special thank you goes to our technician, Kevin Lee, our production assistant, Johan Backer, and, of course, to all our guests that we had on the show, Richard and UVB76, duh. So on behalf of them, this is Keith Pallon all the way in Taipei, Taiwan, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
Hi, this is Ian McFarland. If you're an SWL and feel nostalgic for the good old days of shortwave, you'll be interested in three sets of CDs that Colin Newell and I have produced. The first gives you 100 ident and interval signals from stations around the world. Then there's the foreign language recognition course that will help you identify the myriad languages that you can hear on shortwave. And the newest CD set, a look at the past 20 years in shortwave broadcasting with some of my broadcasting colleagues, and a look into the future. The proceeds from the sale of these CDs are in aid of a charity, a food bank for the less fortunate in my city of Duncan, British Columbia, in Canada. Learn more about these CDs on the dxr.ca internet website. That's dxr.ca. Good listening, everyone.